Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 32 of Real Talk. First and foremost, I want to wish my wife, Courtney, a very happy birthday. The big 4-0 for Courtney, finally joining my decade where I only have 2 years left in my 40s, but happy birthday. On this episode of Real Talk, we have Chris Rising, Rising Realty Partners. I like to call Chris one of the godfathers of real estate podcasting. He has his own podcast. He had me on his podcast several years ago, and it was that experience that was one of the impetus of me wanting to start Real Talk. Chris and I have or had a really candid conversation about today's market. We talk about the office asset class, the types of deals that he's doing now, which are focusing more on light industrial, how lenders are conducting themselves today versus the GFC, what government is doing and really what they're not doing, and how it's impacting CBD office. It's a wide-ranging conversation that I hope you'll enjoy.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with Chris Rising of Rising Realty Partners. Chris, how you doing?
Doing very well. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Well, Chris, we were talking before we started how one of the impetus of Real Talk was you and your podcast. And so this is an honor to have you on. I feel like you were one of the pioneers of having a podcast, especially in the real estate market. And you were gracious to have me on a few years ago, had a great time. And still to this day, people remarkably, several years later, they'll say, hey, I heard you on a podcast with Chris Rising. I'm like, gosh, that was like in 2019 or 18, but it lives forever. And so thank you for having me on. Thank you for coming on. And how are you?
I'm doing well. And I appreciate you asking me. There's only the second one I've done on somebody else's. The other was Chris Powers, Fort Capital. So I'm pleased to do it. You were the impetus for something too, which was when I started the podcast, my idea was how do I get people who can't really afford the tickets to go to some of these big conferences and give people access to people like John Cushman and my father and that kind of generation of things. And I quickly found out that while the audience appreciated hearing stories from 1994, that wasn't as relevant to them as things around how the business is evolving, how technology was playing. So you were one of the first younger experts that I had on the podcast, and it really took it in a different direction that I love. I mean, obviously, this is my father's passed away and John Cushman's passed away. I love that we have the history of those, but I don't think a young person today would find it as relevant what they went through to get library U.S. Bank Tower approved or but what they really want to know is how can I build a business with less people, with more technology? And how do I do the cutting edge things around real estate deals? And so you were important to all of that. So I appreciate it.
Oh, wow. That is, I feel like you're overstating my importance here, but I appreciate it. It was fun talking and, you know, it was the reason why I wanted to have, well, let's be honest. The main reason why I wanted to have this podcast is because it strokes to my ego. Sure, I want my own show, but really we started it in the fall of last year when there wasn't any transactional activity going on. And so it was a way to stay connected with people, had plenty of free time, unlike in 2021 where it was just bonkers. So let's start with that. Tell us, you know, your perspective on today's market. I want to go through the history of of Rising Realty Partners. But let's start with, you know, today we're sitting at the end of August, beginning of September, almost the fourth quarter of 2023. What's your perspective of today's market?
Very schizophrenic. The time I spend in our office portfolio is rather painful, though not dire. We took one shot to the head. That was difficult when we thought we had a deal with a lender and we believed it up till 2 weeks before the loan termed. And then things got as ugly as it's ever been in my career. And this is my third recession as a principal. And if anybody doesn't think office is in recession, I think they're smoking some stuff. But the other half of my life, and I'd say even more than half of my life, is this multi-tenant light industrial. And we've built a really good acquisitions team, and we closed on an off-market deal in San Antonio, about $50 million deal with a really class AAA LP partner. And then on tomorrow, we'll close on another about half that size off-market multi-tenant light industrial in Las Vegas. So, you know, I have a lot of fun with those leasing calls. Not having much fun on the office, though I will tell you, the world is changing, and it's changing so much like the early 90s on office. Is office going to have to be rethought? Absolutely, it'll be rethought, because the technology we use in 94 is different than what we use here in 2023 going into 2024. When I started as a young lawyer at Pillsbury, we had a whole floor for word processing, and that's Microsoft Word today. So the business evolved then, and it's going to evolve now. But we are starting to see these little green shoots that the headlines don't see. And look, if we don't get two or three more of our loan extensions done, it'll be awful and miserable. But I think the lenders are a little bit different than even in the GFC. I think everybody recognizes operators, if they're willing to add new capital, especially around structuring it where you can maybe get a return on that capital ahead of maybe a mezz or something. If you're raising new capital, I think everybody believes if we can just get through this, because this is when I say it's so much like the 90s. Century City got on fire first, Cherry Creek in Denver, you go around the country, and the wealthier office pockets are doing well. The CBDs are doing terrible. I blame the government as much as anything, because governments go to CBDs, and if you're going to only have a government worker work one day every 2 weeks to come pick up a paycheck, you kind of get what you deserve. I say that to the mayors. I say that to the county supervisor. I say that to the governor and to the president. You're just going to have to clean this up by creating another TARP or something, unless you're going to force people back to work. I spend a little bit more time than I want to trying to control politicians, and it goes nowhere. If I hear one more politician tell me, oh, we're afraid if we force them back that they're going to quit, my view is let them quit. Saves your pension, saves a lot. If that's your concern, you know, at some point people do have to eat. Not everybody can quit. But we, you know, in downtown Los Angeles, 250,000 people a day work for the government who are not showing up. And you want to know why petty crime and why homelessness, whether it's San Francisco, Denver, or Los Angeles, it's because the government isn't doing its job. And it's sad. And, you know, you go to try to pull a permit today, there's two people working in an office that used to have 150. You're waiting in these long lines because only two people have shown up. And it's tragic. So that's a lot of my life. The other part of my life is hearing how the landscape company needs, you know, another 5,000 square feet, just a small little office in a warehouse. And, you know, we're seeing it in markets that aren't the CBDs. We're seeing it in Texas. We're seeing it in Las Vegas. We're seeing it in Sacramento. We're seeing it in parts of Eastern California. We're looking at deals in Florida, and that kind of what I think the new economy is really a good place to be in real estate. But every day, you never know. I mean, who knew? I'm gonna tell you how owning real estate, who would have thought this? Yesterday, a Rolls Royce was stolen in San Marino, Pasadena area. Two guys stole it, drove all around, and of all the buildings in all of Los Angeles, they picked. They pulled into our trust building, came out with guns and a backpack and dumped the car, ran throughout the building. Our security was terrific, but they hid their guns and they left. So, I mean, it makes it hard to say to people, yeah, come to downtown and go to work every day when you've got these kind of, I had to just chuckle that you got to be kidding.
I heard that story. I didn't realize they went into your building.
I don't even know how they did it because ours is a small, this is a historic building with a small garage, but of all, you know, and I never get this lucky on the lottery. I don't know why it happens on these kind of things.
But so what happened to the car?
The cops towed it. And then when we found the guns, they came and got it and we have them all on video. I mean, it was not a very smart move, but
yeah. So, but eventually they'll get caught. You would think, yeah. But
that's what makes real estate fun, right?
Yeah. You know what? I think when you go to school or go into real estate, that story is not one that you would expect to happen, but you know, when you're in real estate, property management, anything can happen these days. Well, I mean, look, we could take this conversation anywhere. And thank you for that opening perspective. You know, the thing that really caught my attention is these deals that you're doing, these, you know, lighter industrial deals and having capital partners transact in today's market, because all I'm hearing and seeing from my clients and just seeing it from our workflow, that for the most part, institutional capital is on the sidelines, that they're window shoppers, that their fear is that if they commit to a deal today, that deal will be 10% or worse, 20% less in a month or two. And they're just waiting for distress. So how is it that you've been able to transact and capitalize your deals with, and I'm assuming it's institutional capital, maybe it's friends and family and or smaller family office, but what was it about these deals?
Well, I would say this, every one of these deals have not been marketed by the big names in brokerage. They all have a story to them around distress. For instance, one of the assets we bought from a family office, they were having distress in their office portfolio. They needed liquidity. They didn't want the world to know about it. We stepped in quickly, closed faster than we had to, and it provided opportunity. One of the other things we did, you know, there's this new concept. It's not new, but a concept called negative leverage, which quite literally means if you're buying something at a 7 cap, but your debt's at an 8 cap, you have, your debt's at an 8, you have a negative leverage. And it doesn't necessarily mean you can't solve it with doing all cash or buying down the rate. And that's what we've been doing. We've been buying caps that buy down our rate, give us a little bit more cash flow early. Another deal, we've been just circling it for 2 years. It made a lot of sense for us to buy it. And they were at the end of a fund life. You know, the thing is, even if times are bad, things, you know, like leases turn, but so do loans and so do fund lives. And, you know, there are reasons they have to transact. And that's what I think ultimately gets us out of this rut of pessimism. It's pure herd mentality. When you are arbitrarily choosing to underwrite something with a 10 cap rate today, but it was a 6 a year ago, does that mean that the underlying cash flow is any less? Doesn't usually not. Does the credit any worse? Probably not. It's just, this is where it ebbs and flows. I think the biggest problem that you see right now in terms of velocity of the market is the players that had lots of capital, because they have these open-ended funds, the S-REIT, the B-REIT. They have had so many redemptions that if you go to most markets, they're not there driving it. And so it's smaller operators with institutional capital who wants to beat those brand names out and for this next cycle, and it's family offices. So, you know, our goal is to buy 2 deals a quarter across the country of this stuff. Hopefully we get, you know, if we settle in on 1 1/4, that's good. But we want 2, and you're just not fine. But you're not, you know, I can't pick up the phone and call Dollar Londo and say, hey, why don't you give me this deal that nobody's talking about? That is not what makes Darla great or her team great. Theirs is getting it out to the market, creating a market, getting people to pay the highest price. That is a game we can't play in. And we couldn't get the capital for it, quite frankly, because, you know, it doesn't have the sophistication or the value add play that we specialize in. And so, you know, I don't see an office deal transaction. I have some dear friend, Michael Barker, who bought some stuff from B-REIT in Orange County. And signed a 40,000 square foot lease on something we used to own when I was at McGuire. And, you know, he just felt like the price was so low and he got some leasing momentum. But I don't think for the most part you're going to see office for a while. I do hear rumblings that there are going to be one or two really ugly sales in downtown LA that will set the market. I assume that has to be something Brookfield's giving back or something like that. I don't know. But I don't know. We got to keep living. I mean, if you look at, this is something that it was a tweet I read from somebody on hashtag retweet. And it was really interesting because I thought it hit it perfectly. You know, the average real estate deal takes 3 to 5, like we all underwrite 3 to 5 years, sometimes 7 years. And it takes about 6 months before you buy something. And you put that plan in motion. If you think about it, it's been 3 years since the COVID started, and this whole thing got juiced up with low interest rates and then now it's pulled back. So most people are kind of at that beginning stage, or worse, they're in their seventh year because they've had to take their extensions. And it just means that this is all going to start shaking loose right around right now. So that, you know, you can't, my dad always say, you can't judge whether the knife is falling or not. At some point, you got to have the guts to go and say, I'm putting a stake in the ground. We feel good about it. I mean, I don't think on some of the hiccups that have happened, you know, who would have told us, I mean, who knew there was going to be a pandemic, then riots in the front of our building in downtown LA, and then homeless that still use the streets as bathrooms. You know, none of those things were happening before. We had one of the highest sales per square foot in 2015 under all the same theories that we had on some of our other office. And so, you know,
Was that the Pac Mutual building?
Yeah, that was Pac Mutual. But I don't know. I get tired of Twitter in some respects because everybody's perfect and that's not life. And if you are, I wouldn't invest with you because nobody bats 1,000. They just don't. And so I think you have to own up to deals that don't go the way you want and then be humble when things go really well and have a lot of processes and systems. And that's what we pride ourselves on, is using technology as a force multiplier, being out in the market, not sitting behind a desk all the time. But I don't know. It's a weird world right now, because I think a lot of people want to wish that office will always be office, and they want to wish that interest rates will only be 2%. But, you know, we're just above where interest rates were right before the GFC. You know, they were raising those interest rates because the economy was heating up. We're just a little higher than that. I think we are one bank failure, which will come because of this, the high interest rates, away from a pause and interest rates starting to come down. And you got to play through. That's all I can say. I mean, if you can find the deals, always speak for themselves. You know, I've learned that over the years. I can't tell you how many times I've beat my head against the wall trying to tell a Wall Street private equity firm why this is a good deal, and they don't do it with us, but they do it with somebody else and all that stuff. But, you know, the deal is what should be the driver of it, and a good deal can still get done. That's my view.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, there's a perspective that we are sitting on an opportunity over the next 6-12 months. Is it going to be longer? Maybe not. Of a great buying opportunity, and we're going to have this bounce back for a variety of reasons. Overall, you know, economy is seem strong. Fundamentals seem, you know, very secure, and that we're going to have this initial dip and have had this dip, and that if you're never going to catch the bottom, and if you don't transact in the next whatever it is, 6 to 12 months, we may miss that bottom and we're going to be kicking ourselves.
I don't know. That's why you got to be showing up every day and playing, you know. We don't live in a world where you show up at an office at 7 a.m. and stay till 7 p.m. and you're there 60 hours a week. But we do live in a world where the harder you work, the luckier you get. And I think that's a little bit lost on people, that somehow Friday is not a real work day anymore. And I think it's lost on young people specifically. And I think, you know, my prediction is we're going to see huge unemployment over the next 3 years. as AI continues to wipe away beginner jobs, jobs that people would get right out of college. And you're either, the jobs for the young people are going to be with big, big companies, and they're going to force you in the office. And if you don't want to do that, then there's not a job for you. And then there's going to be the nimbler firms that figure out a hybrid schedule that kind of works for everybody, but it still has two or three quality days of human interaction. And I think people are going to say, I can just do a lot more with less. And so I'm pretty pessimistic about the economy over the next 2 or 3 years. I'm very optimistic about certain areas of the economy, healthcare. I think anything that actually takes physical labor, and that's why I like industrial so much. I mean, those jobs aren't going away. It's the desk jobs that fill office buildings that I think really are going to be meant for big companies. And, you know, smaller companies will take more transitional space. They'll, you know, we're just not going to see, I don't see a 100,000 square foot law firm being signed in any other major city outside of New York. I just don't. I think they'll do 25 and have three offices and have people meet, you know, in downtown 1 month and in West LA the other month. And I think office is fundamentally changing, and it's just reality. That's what happened. You know, after my kids want to kick me, but I made them watch a scene from an old Dolly Parton movie called 9 to 5, because I wanted them to see how different the world was in the 70s, that there was a job for a typist. And at this company, they had a whole floor, huge floor with huge ceilings, and it was all typists. And I'm like, see, this is what happens in the world if you don't pay attention. You train for a job that gets taken away by technology. And that's what's happening in the office realm. And, you know, I can see I can't even believe it because my dad's probably spinning when I say this, but I can, you know, we got rid of suits, which killed them.
I mean, well, look how we're dressed.
We got rid of suits. For the most part, we got rid of the early work hours where somebody cared if your light was on at 7:30 in the morning in your office. And now what we're expecting is productivity. And I think that's what's being lost by people, is that somehow you can half-ass things. So that's how people are going to get deals done. They work harder than other people. That's how it's going to happen.
Yeah, well, it's the old-fashioned way. And COVID definitely set our mindset, or the younger generation's mindset, differently. And I think there's going to be a rude awakening, because a sustained sluggishness in the economy or just in transactions means that those that are not working hard will be expendable. And we see it in the law firm industry. 2021, we couldn't hire enough lawyers to keep up with the demand. You fast forward 12, 18 months, the major law firms are cutting back on attorneys. They're being more critical in their performance reviews and reducing that way. And if things don't change here in the next quarter or two, I think there's going to be drastic reductions in the labor force, in these, you know, white collar professional ranks. Because it's only so, how long can these law firms sustain keeping, you know, lawyers underutilized? And it's also in the real estate world and real estate private equity, where all the acquisitions folks have turned into asset managers. Well, at some point, you're going to have just a glut of these asset managers because they're not doing deals.
But I would also say there's so much software that does things that people used to do. You know, I get very frustrated dealing with office brokers who are my age or older, who somehow think VTS is still the Excel spreadsheet that you send out every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell people, if you want to work for us, I want to know exactly what that tour was like, when it happened, what happened. I want to know what the proposal looks like, because you feed that up there. And I want to know how it compares against the net effective rent, budget and actual. And if you can't do all that stuff, I don't need you, because I don't really have time for a call to go through things that I can do in real time. We can do that once a month. There's this unwillingness I see for people to adapt to, and I see it in the legal industry. It's just unbelievable to me that when they scoff at AI. No, I'm sorry. You're going to have to learn to work with AI, because that's what's going to happen. I, you know, one of the things we've been trying to do in the office side for 25, 30 years is standardize an office lease. Mm-hmm. Instead of having these lease negotiations that go off on tangents, AI is going to do that. You know, it's going to take 10 years, but it's a standardized lease in industrial. And, you know, that's one of my other theories is I think the days of 140 a TI square foot and TIs like we have right now, are this is kind of the peak of it. I think you're going to see office landlords do whatever they can to standardize their office space unless the tenant wants to pay for it. And it just think of all the jobs that go away when all this happens. And when someone's asked me about being a young broker, I said, yeah, I just don't know how you learn at 22 years old if your expectation is I can do this 3 or 4 days a week. And I don't mean to sound old that way, but that's how I learned. I sat in on calls and and so if you're not willing to come in, and I was just in Denver last week and I saw both CBRE and JLL and they were full. Then I go down two floors and look at a law firm and it was empty. And I'm like, this doesn't work if you're a young person wanting to be mentored. So that's why I go back to, I think there'll always be jobs like for Microsoft. They're just the new oil companies, right? So you get out of school, you're smart, you're trained in Excel and you can do finance. You can go work. They're going to tell you to come in to work here. You know, that's why, I tell my kids a lot, just do something you love, but don't think it's going to be easy. You know, the teachers are still showing up every day, the trainers, the doctors, there's cops, the fire. It's so bad. It's such a bad statement on wealth and privilege that somehow the most educated, most well-paid are like, no, I don't need to go in and be around other people.
Yeah.
But I do think it's a reality that it's hard to tell someone drive an hour to come and do what you can do at home. So employers are going to have to make it worthwhile for someone to drive an hour. That's going to be the challenge.
Yeah. So whether it's experiential real estate where people feel good about the office, whether it has, outdoor areas, rooftop areas, just a culture within the office that makes them want to put on clothes.
I think that's the most important culture. I don't think, having the rooftop sauna is what's going to drive it. It's the employers say it's worthwhile to come in for this many hours during the week. And we make it worth your while given the meetings we have and what we do, because, office buildings always get repurposed and they always get upgraded. And so, it was going on pre-pandemic. We were spending all this money trying to create these aesthetic experiences. That's what Pac Mutual was, the trust was. So I don't think that's going to drive people in. It's going to be that dynamic employers figure out ways to make it worth people's time to come in, and they don't ask them to do stupid stuff. I think where employees have had a very legitimate gripe is it's not like the only place I can work is in the office. It's not like that's where my big files are. So if you're going to ask me to come in and do these things and do it, you got to make it worthwhile.
Yeah.
And we'll see. I think that's quite frankly, that's one of the problems with some of the law firms I see today, the big law firms is, put those meetings on days where you're going to get young people get a lot out of it. But if you're going to tell someone to go into a office and shut the door and go work for 4 hours straight, that's not what you want them in the office for.
I agree. Now let's talk about, obviously, your family's history with downtown LA, essentially one of the most, fundamental builders of downtown LA is your father and the company of Rising Realty. And as you see downtown LA today in 2023, obviously you talked about, how government has really failed us. And it's really just sad. I'm a Los Angelino. You're a Los Angelino. Was your dad born in Los Angeles?
He was not born. He was born in Queens, but he was here since fifth grade.
Okay. Raised in LA. And it is sad to see. What do you think the future is of downtown LA? And I don't know how you would know the number of square feet in downtown LA. How does that get absorbed? And if we were to fast forward 5-10 years, what does downtown LA look like?
Good question. And first of all, everything's cyclical. We've put billions upon billions of dollars of infrastructure and made downtown LA the center. It's the center of the wheel. All these spokes go out. I remember in the early 90s, you know, when NWA was big and there was riots and there was crime. I remember, you know, my parents saying, don't go to Westwood because
I was going to say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think everything's cyclical. We will have enough at some point, you know, hopefully Mayor Bass will continue doing at a faster pace what she's trying to do. But at some point people just get tired of it if she doesn't, and we'll have a mayor that comes in. It happened throughout history, happened in New York City and all that. There's too much investment in public infrastructure for downtown LA to have 10 years of what it has right now. I just don't believe. We also have the World Cup coming and we have the Olympics. And if you want to see how downtown LA gets its act together, look what happened in downtown LA when the Super Bowl came or when the Dodgers had the All-Star game. All of a sudden, all those homeless tents were gone. They weren't permanent, but we had enough guts for a few weeks to do it. And I think whether it's LA or San Francisco or Chicago, those things are going to improve. And it's just how we allocate our resources. You know, when someone decides crime really affects them. I think these mass robberies are affecting everybody and scaring everybody. And so the claims of too many police officers being a bad thing is going to be, we need more police officers. And I just see that in society. So that's one thing. The second thing is, not cynical about it. I actually love it because we're here in Los Angeles and movie business is big. But I really think we're one or two great television shows or movies away from this Gen Z saying we want to be back downtown. You know, all something that says being in an office is great and having your multiple friendships and relationships. I mean, you know, Friends came out in the early 90s and all of a sudden it was cool to live in New York City again. You know, I do think there's
We need L.A. Law, the revival. Yeah,
I do think there's a little bit of that. And then I think there's this one thing that is just we can't get away from, which is housing is so expensive. You can't leave one area totally neglected. We have now 90,000 plus people living in downtown LA full time. That's a pretty big city in and of itself. So as people look at, like, I need to buy a house somewhere. I need to buy a condo. I need to live somewhere. And maybe I don't have to have a car because I'm near transit. Those things are going to come. Does it do much good in the next 12 or 24 months? No. I mean, the servicer doesn't listen to that and say, great, I'll extend your loan. So then there's going to be that pain. But I just think these things are transitory. I mean, I go back talking about movies. Just go look at the movie Her, which one of the great movies ever, Spike Jonze's movie, and how he envisioned L.A. And it really was all this public transportation. And now you have these strip malls along the way, and all those strip malls get torn out and big towers get built for housing. And I think that'll be – so you asked me what L.A. is going to be. I think downtown L.A. will be close to 200,000 people in 10 years. I think the train system will be unbelievably used but probably still have its dangers. And I think we'll cycle through – we want a lot more police officers and more presence. And then we'll have human nature being human nature. We'll have something ugly happen, and it'll swing back. I mean, it's just – that's, you know, that's why diversify – if I've learned anything as a principal over the last 10 or 15 years, diversification is huge. And it's hard because all this money wants you to be an expert. You're the downtown LA office expert. Well, okay. Well, you're making your bets across the country. I'm in one place and that place goes under, I'm screwed. So I think trying to learn early on that you can be an expert in other markets is important.
Well, in our remaining few minutes, talk about, cause I know you and the companies, historically, you guys were predominantly in the office asset class, and your more recent transactions have been in industrial. Yeah. How has it been transitioning into industrial? How have the capital markets and the capital providers perceived you and your company in pivoting to industrial? Has it been challenging? And do you think you're going to do office deals again?
Office deals again, if we get approached, if we have a theory about occupancy that we think holds water, which we do not have yet, we have ideas about it, we would willingly go back into office because we really like to manage Class A office. We think we do it well. We think we do it differently than the third party providers. So we might. But so our firm was started in 2012, but in 2007, it was the original birth. My dad had sold Catellus to Prologis in 2005. I'd had my own life and my own company. I'd been a young lawyer, and then had Rising Real Estate Group and did a bunch of deals with Michael Barker. My dad and I started forming Rising Realty Partners in 2007. 2008, he got a call to go be the CEO at McGuire, said, hey, I've started to build this team. I got to bring them over. We were there for 2 years through 2011, 2010, 2011 period. We restarted Rising Realty Partners in 2011, bought PAC Mutual in 2012. The opportunities that came our way that made sense were office. We always said, how can we not have Nelson Rising, who had this industrial REIT that he sold, took over at $400 million market cap, sold for $5.4 billion market cap. How can we not be in industrial? So in 2019, my friend from Duke University, who is a real star in real estate, Scott McMullen, he was at HFF, started the West Coast for HFF, had been investing in our deals. And I had lunch with him and I said, Scott, I need some help. My dad's getting older, need to raise some money. So Scott invested in the company. And at the same time as when my dad started to get a little bit ill, and we made the decision, we got to get a deal done in industrial while Nelson's still a part of it. And we bought something in El Monte. It was a super home run. That one deal then gave us credibility to go to other markets. We did use, you were unbelievably helpful about crowdfunding. And we did a couple deals in crowdfunding just to get things going. And now we're doing deals with the biggest private equity LPs. But it's been a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, a lot of SOPs. One thing I think people want to throw up at our company is Scott and I use the term SOP. What's our standard operating procedure all the time? Something gets screwed up. We had, after the security thing happened with the Rolls Royce, we went through, what are our SOPs if somebody comes in? Did we follow them? So we have all the processes in place. Quite frankly, it's taken 10 years to get where we are. We've had some really big wins, had a tough loss. Hopefully we won't have any more of those. But I see us as a national real estate firm focusing on industrial and industrial outdoor storage, unless the light bulb comes on with office. I just think there's 2 to 5 years of pain. Yeah, they say the best of the best are going to survive. Well, I don't know what the best of the best is. Is it 100% location, or is it because you have the coolest amenities? I don't know yet. And until corporate America decides what it means to work a corporate job, I don't think anybody knows.
Yeah. And so, I have a lot of clients who have pivoted to industrial, whether they were office clients pivoting, even multifamily clients who do the barbell of multifamily and industrial, which I find fascinating that they're able to do both. Is there a concern that the competition of so many operators and sponsors chasing industrial is just going to make it just that much more challenging to succeed in that asset class? What are your thoughts about that?
I think a good deal speaks for itself. That's mm-hmm. what I say to people all the time. You can be Blackstone, but if you're just buying retail all the time, you're not gonna be working at Blackstone very long. So a good deal speaks for itself. Second thing, competition is good and it is healthy and it weeds things out. And if 5 more office players decide they can all of a sudden do multi-tenant line industrial, good luck. I hope they can do it. You're going to learn a lot of lessons. So the question is, is your capital going to want to learn them with you? Yeah. And, some people do and some people don't. So I think the hardest part is getting not your first acquisition, but your first turn, buying, operating, selling, getting into the promote and all of that. If you can get there, then I think you're in a good spot. But I would say to everybody, man, if that's what you want to do and it's your dream, just work your ass off and go do it. But, don't make, there'll be, if you call enough people enough times and you have a persuasive argument and you start with a good deal, someone's going to back you. If not, I'd be looking in the mirror and saying, what is it about the company, myself, and all that isn't, and go kind of shore up those weaknesses. And if,
yeah, All right. So my final question here, because you've sat on so many different sides of the real estate business, from law, brokerage, principal, office, industrial. Let's say you're 25 years old or even younger, 22 years old, just getting out of college. Where would Chris Rising, 22 years old, or maybe you're telling your kids if they want to be in real estate, where would you tell them to start their career? if they want to be in the real estate. If they want to be
in the real estate. That's a good caveat because.
Yeah. Because me, I would have been an executive for the Dodgers. I should have done that, but it's all good. I have a successful law practice and I'd go pay to watch the Dodgers play.
I'd been a producer is probably what I would have done. I like telling stories. And I like that. But what I would say, if you really want to be in real estate, you have to start with a specialization because the world does not have time anymore in real estate for the really good student who's like me, had a major in history and a major in political science, because there are no books to put together. There's nothing. So get a specialization, get an Argus, and especially do it around finance. If you want to be a broker, the brokerage business has changed so much. It's hard to get in as a young broker if you don't have those skills. So get a specialization. It doesn't mean necessarily go to business school, though I would encourage it for everybody. And I didn't. I went to law school. But you got to be able to come in and add value day one. And what used to be adding value in the real estate business doesn't, there's just not that role for the great athlete that used to be. And it's too competitive. And so I would say, go tell somebody that I'm really good at Argus or I'm really good at finance. I can help you on day one. And the other thing I would say is get out and learn how to speak. You take whatever classes, you know, a lot of people don't know about me, but after I got frustrated with the law, I spent a year and a half, 2 years trying to be an actor and took acting classes and realized quickly I didn't want my life decided by a casting agent. But the reason I can do what I do without notes and all that stuff is I spent a lot of time working on being an actor. So I think too many people come out of school and they don't have the ability to sell the deal. And you got to have that. It's not just the skill set of the finance. That's fine. There may be a role for you, but you'll be capped. But it gets you in the door. But figure out how you can go be an advocate for deals, because that's what real estate is. You know, it says, I don't care what asset class it is. You have to have the fundamentals financially and you have to be an advocate for your deals.
By the way, it's law. It's any business where you're selling. And you know, I've said this to people before. I'm amazed how little communication classes there are in school and how, I mean, you interview a lot of people. I interview a lot of people. We communicate with a lot of people. And there are very few people who have really persuasive communication skills, verbal communication skills. Don't just hide behind a computer and email, but
or whatever language texting is today. It's like, we start to see it slip into emails with a conversation day on our asset manager. I'm like, when we talk to outside people, no slang. You write like a professional. And I just think it's because people get so used to just mangling the English language on a text. You know, my kids text me, there are two of them in college. I don't even know what they're saying. I have to say something like this. And then people are bringing that to business and they wonder why they're not getting anything done.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your perspective on that. And, you know, thank you for coming on to the show. I loved coming on to your show, when I did a few years ago, and, you know, your, experience, has really just shown people that, you know, you have to have nine lives in this industry
of any industry. Yeah, this one is particularly, it's very cyclical. The movie business is not, necessarily cyclical. But in our business, you have to realize when it's really good, you got to be looking behind you a little bit. When it's really bad, you got to be looking forward, because it's a sick, by its nature, it's a real estate cycle. So it's going to go up and down.
Yeah. Well, who said when the tide goes out, you'll see who's naked and not wearing clothes.
But that's quite a luxury not to have to have debt. Our business is based on debt, and think about our whole home business. Can you imagine people coming out of college and starting a family and not having access to debt to buy a home? I mean, we're not. So because of that, we're at the vagaries of interest rates going up and down for the broader economy, and real estate will always be affected. And that's
just great. No, absolutely. Well, thank you for coming on. Thank you for your perspective, and best of luck with the closing tomorrow and hopefully many deals to come.
All right, my man. Good to see you. I'll see you again soon.
You got it, Chris. All right. Thanks. Take care. Thanks.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.